I'm still the speaker. Oh my goodness. Hey everybody, I'm an alcoholic and my name's Uncle Jim. And it appears I'm still the speaker captain, which I just gave to Tammy illegitimately just a minute ago. Okay. Wow. What can I say about Israel? Were you born in Israel?
No.
Okay, he was not born in Israel. Now, I met Israel, I believe, in person prior to COVID. And from what I know about Israel, he's like a go-getter alcoholic. And what I've seen is the fact that from the get-go, he's really taken on service positions that help our AA community out right away. I'm probably telling you half his story right now. So if we can give it up for Israel, who's not born in Israel, then that's okay. That'd be wonderful.
Oh, man. I'm the Israel alcoholic.
Hi, Israel.
And thank you guys for inviting me to speak. You know, preparing for this speech, speech or whatever you want to call this, okay, I'm so nervous, all right, you know, I felt anxiety for like the 2 weeks of building up to coming here, and I thought it would be a good, maybe an object example of how the program works in my life, just to share how I kind of dealt with that off the bat. So I do want to read a little section here from the big book. It says, it's from step four. And it says, we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper even though we had no resentment in connection with them. We asked ourselves why we had them. Was it because of self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. And here's the good news. Perhaps there's a better way. We think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. So I wrote my fears out. I was afraid of failing, freezing up here and not knowing what to say, saying something wrong. And, you know, the lesson here for me is to trust God. And so I followed my training and meditated and asked, you know, what... You know, help me here, God, to do the right thing. What's my purpose here? And the purpose is really for me to share my experience, strength, and hope. And if you hear something that you can use, use it. And if you hear something that you don't like or you don't agree with, just ignore that. All right? So, by the way, it is great to be here in person. I have missed getting to see my AA peeps. For real. I love Zoom, and hi all you Zoom people, but absolutely. It's awesome to be here in person. And anyway, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So what was it like? All right. You know, I talked about fear right off the bat, and that permeated my life before. Even going back to high school, you know, I didn't fit in. I was the nerd. I did homeschool for a while, and that made it even more hard to go back to regular school when I did. And so, you know, I just dealt with it by being a recluse and not ever talking to anybody. And I always just had this, you know, this weight in my heart all the time. And I one day discovered alcohol. You know, I was riding around with my cousin. And her dad owned like the C store there, convenience store there in town. It was a little bitty town, 300 people. So we went and got a little 4-pack of wine coolers. And I had my first one, and I was like, why did we only get four? So she had one, and I drank the other three, and I'm like, we got to go back for more. This is it, man. I finally felt that. Ability to relax and, you know, not feel so self-conscious and turned into kind of like a little bit of a different person. And so that, you know, that tipped off my drinking career, and it started slowly, you know. Going forward a little bit, you know, I didn't have a whole lot of access. I know she was my cousin, but she wouldn't, like, give me beer all the time. So it was few and far between, but I tell you, whenever I got my hands on it, I sure did drink as much as I possibly could. And no amount of hangovers or consequences deterred that for me. So let's fast forward a little bit. I joined the Army in my 20s and got deployed to Bosnia. And they don't let you drink on the American posts in, you know, overseas like that in country. And so, man, I was going nuts because I drank a lot at that point, you know, and not being able to drink and just being cooped up on that post was torture. So me and my buddies had cooked up some plans. We had some friends that were translators that knew Bosnian, and we snuck out at night. We borrowed the commander's vehicle, you know, as you do, and went downtown in the middle of the night. And if you can just imagine, you know, a couple of 20-year-olds, one of my friends had what we call a squad assault weapon, and this thing weighs like, I don't know, 45 pounds. It's this gigantic thing. And he was given this weapon because he had pissed off the first sergeant, who's like a bigwig in our unit, and he's like, you're carrying this thing in country the whole time. And so we go down there, and we change our clothes in, you know, in our friend's house, but we still have to keep this weapon with us. And here's the image, you know. There's a house on the street, and these two, you know, military-looking guys, but we're in civvies, coming out with all these weaponry. You know, the people were looking at us like we were crazy. Who are these insane people coming out of the house with this stuff? What's going on? And so we, you know, we started our little party thing. We'd get vodka, put it in little water bottles, bring it back on post, and sell it to our buddies. I mean, you could get like $20 per bottle of vodka on the post. And it made a pretty good business. It kept us in drinking. We started selling some other things, too, to finance our drinking. And one day we ended up selling some to a CID agent. And, you know, I was kind of dumb to that, I guess. You know, she had a sidearm, and in the military, the only people that carry the sidearms are aircraft crew people or the police. And I'm like, what are you doing with this sidearm? I don't ever see you on the flight line. Oh, you know, you just never, I'm new. You know, I transferred over from another post. Okay, here you go. And, you know, one fine morning at around, I don't know, 4:30, I just come off guard duty. They beat down my door and came in, and, you know, you're here. There's probably 10 people busted in there, 10 military police, hollering different things for you to do. Get on the floor, freeze, put your hands up, put your hands behind your head. And I'm like, dear God, don't shoot me because I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And, you know, I got my rank taken away. I ended up in jail in Germany for 30 days. And for a cream puff like me, that was like, you know, I thought I was in prison. I've since learned that's not prison. And it was quite a phone call to have to make to your, you know, to my wife, where I couldn't talk about the case, and I just had to say, hey, you thought I was coming home next month, but I don't know when I'm going to be home. Could be 6 months, could be a year, and I can't talk about it. So that was really hard. You know, and so I did the 30 days in jail, and came back home, and, you know, this is, a rational person would think, all of those events that led up to that happening were caused by my drinking, because I wanted to finance my drinking career, and I didn't. I just thought, what can I do to not get caught next time? And maybe I should just dry out for a year. So I tried that, drying out for a year, and that was not comfortable. You know, and so I don't know if I made it a whole year, but, you know, I tried. And then I got to thinking, well, maybe it was what I was drinking. Maybe it was the vodka. So I did just like we talk about in that preamble at the beginning, you know, or whatever chapter that we read there, where you switch from vodka to whiskey to tequila. I'm like, you know, that's all it is. I just got to find the right mix so that I don't go crazy. And to describe what alcoholism is for me, it means that I can't not pick up the first drink. And then when I do pick up that first drink, I don't know what's going to happen. You know, I don't know how long I'm going to drink. I don't know how many I'm going to have. Because you always have big plans. I'm only going to have a couple, and then I'm going to stop at a particular time so I can drive home. And I drove home drunk all the time. You know, it got so bad. At one point, I did eventually go back to my vodka and the water bottle. Driving a 45-minute commute home every day, just drinking the whole way home. And by the time I got home, I was pretty lit. You know? So this got progressively worse, okay? It started just every weekend, all day, every weekend. And then it was during the weekday. One of my friends at work was like, well, you could drink during the weekdays. You know, whatever your family doesn't know won't hurt you. And I was like, God dang, that's a good idea. So I started doing that. I'd go hide out in the basement and just tear it up, you know, giant liter of vodka nearly every day. And then I started drinking at work. And, you know, this got progressively worse. And the big book also talks about that, how it gets worse and worse and worse. It doesn't ever get any better. And maybe I could put together a couple weeks of time not drinking, but it always came back just as hard as it was before. It didn't matter. You know, I ended up moving to Visalia. I can kind of say it was for work, but if I'm really honest with myself, I think it was what we call a geographic, just maybe a change of the venue will fix me. That ought to work, and it didn't. It just got worse. And so my drinking and other outside issues got to where 4 years ago I was staying up for days on end, and you know, I'm laying in bed at night, my heart's just thumping in my chest, just waiting for my wife to come to bed and fall asleep so that I can get up and go downstairs and drink some more. And it got to the point where I was, like, paranoid. I was, you know, thinking people were out to get me. I wasn't doing my job. You know, my wife told me that if she would have had the money, she would have been gone. And even that, even so hard, I wanted to stop, you know. I saw that it was causing pain for my family, and I just couldn't do it. You know, I would try, and I couldn't. I'd try, and I couldn't. And it's just, it was this mystery to me. Why would I keep doing that? My car would just drive right to the liquor store. I'd read a bunch of Arnold Schwarzenegger stuff and be like, yeah, I'm going to go work out, and I'm going to drive past the liquor store today. And I'd end up right there in the liquor store again. It just seemed like the car would drive there on its own volition, and there I would be. So, what finally happened? Well, it wasn't working anymore. All the different types of alcohol and outside issues that I was drinking wasn't working. And so, in my mind, you know, when I drink and drink and drink and drink, and I'm not getting drunk enough, and my mind's not getting so far out here where I can totally forget about my stuff, that's just another level of craziness. And so I thought that the solution to my problem would be, you know what, maybe I need to smoke cannabis openly. That's a good idea. So I told that to my wife, my genius idea. And she was like, you know what, if you do that, I'm gone. I don't care if I have any money or not. I'm out of here. And I said, okay, you know what? Let's go to marriage counseling, because I think maybe you don't know what you're talking about. And this marriage therapist will surely set you straight. So we started going to a marriage therapist, and, you know, this whole time I was hiding the extent of my drinking from my wife, you know, or at least doing my best to. So, and just keep that in mind. So we're going to this marriage counselor, and I learned a couple things right off the bat. You don't want to be too drunk before you go in there. Okay? You don't want to stay up all night and come in there. And I can remember vividly one time where she was wanting us to say three or four things that were important to us within a relationship, and then the other person had to repeat it back. And so my wife tells me those four things, and I can't even remember what I said at the beginning of the sentence by the time I got to the end of the sentence. And so I'm like, the whole time I'm trying to remember these four things while there's conversations going on, you know, and I'm like, oh my gosh. And so I finally get all four out by the skin of my teeth when it comes time to say them. And the therapist was putting all these psychological reasons why I gave him that particular order. And I'm just like, man, if you only knew. The order was not what was going on there. You know, it was just me trying to get by. So we did this for a while, maybe 6 months. And the last time we went there, I had my weekend planned out. I wasn't too drunk. I just had a couple sips, you know, to get me going. And I had bought my alcohol. It was at home, ready to go. And I think it was a Friday or it was a Thursday with a Friday off or something. It was going to be a really nice weekend. And so we get in the car, and my wife runs back in the house, something she forgot, comes back, and off we go. So we waltz into the therapist's office, and she starts the small talk. Hey, Israel, how was your week? Oh, man, my week was great. And in my mind, it's like, as soon as we're out of here, it's going to get even better. It's going to be awesome. I can handle this session without any issues. And then she turned to my wife and asked how your week was going. And unbeknownst to me, my wife had gone through the house and picked up all my little empty alcohol bottles that I had stashed everywhere. And I thought it was a secret. I didn't think she knew where all these things were. And put them in a giant, giant bag in her purse. I mean, there were so many there that there was no excuse that I could come up with that would justify the quantity. And she pulls it out of her bag and just goes, bam, right on the table, right in front of me and the therapist, and said, that's how my week was. That's it right there. And we talk about moments of clarity in this program, and that was mine. It was at that moment, and I didn't even really understand about higher powers at that point, but I know now, looking back, that was when my higher power reached down and thumped me in the head and said, listen up, this is it. This is how you can get, stop drinking finally. And, through those depths, I was able to see somewhat clearly, more clearly than I'd seen before, what I was doing to my family and the lies I was telling myself that, this is only hurting me. It's not hurting anybody else. You know, those were all lies. It was impacting my family and my kids and my friends and my job. It was impacting every single thing I was doing in my life. And that was my last drink right before that therapy session. So I ended up coming to a AA meeting at the Lutheran Church right down the street on a Tuesday night. And some of you guys were there. I think maybe you were there. Alan L. was there. He was my first AA speaker that I heard. I don't know if you know him, but he's a cool guy. And I was so scared. I was so nervous just to come in the doors. I thought I was really going to be anonymous in there. Even though I'm scared, I'll sit in the back and no one will know I'm the new guy, because there's a lot of new guys in these rooms. And so so I sat back there, and everybody started coming up to me. Hey, man, how's it going? Welcome. I'm like, oh, crap. They're not doing that to everybody else. What is going on? But I really appreciated that, because I was so standoffish, and I didn't have the social skills to reach across and talk to people. And you guys did that. You came around, and man, I'm so grateful for that. It means a lot, you know? I remember two guys took me outside. Ken, if you're on Zoom, you were one of those two guys. You took me outside after the meeting, and you just talked to me. you know, for like half an hour after the meeting, and you answered my questions and said it was going to be all right. You know, just make it to that next meeting, and it's all right if you don't understand everything that's going on. It'll come. You're in the right place. It's going to be awesome. And I didn't know what the minute was going to be awesome because I didn't think you could have fun being an alcoholic. I've since learned better. You absolutely can. Through these meetings, I learned a lot of things at the beginning. You know, like Ken would always say, I never saw a grateful alcoholic get drunk. And we talk a lot about gratitude. Even before I started doing the steps and getting a sponsor, that stuck out for me. The amount of gratitude that everybody had in these rooms was unbelievable. I've never seen anybody really be that grateful for a program ever. You know, that many people. Maybe a couple people here and there, but not like so many people in the rooms. And it really stuck out to me. And the passion I heard in people's voices when they talked about it just really, really stuck. And so I did hear that a lot too. Hey, you have a sponsor yet? No. Oh, okay. Well, you know what? It worked for me. I really didn't get a lot of relief from this disease until I got a sponsor. And that went on for a couple months. And you guys were super patient with me and would just keep, hey, man, this worked for me. And the unspoken was, it'll work for you too. But you never actually said, you need to get a sponsor. I mean, you do. But you didn't do that to me. And I really appreciated that kid glove kind of approach. Some people need the kick in the ass and some people need it. There's a nut for every screw, my sponsor likes to say. And so I finally did. I walked out of a meeting one day and worked up the courage, so nervous, to go ask somebody to be my sponsor. Man, it probably took me a couple weeks to really figure out how I was going to do this. But it was way easier than I thought it was going to be. I just walked up to my sponsor and said, hey, I think I probably need to do these steps. And he goes, yeah, you probably do. And he met me at Denny's. We had our introduction and started to go through the steps. And let me tell you, that is where I found the relief in his program. The relief from that awful weight in my heart, the relief from this everyday anxiety and anger at people. I wanted to tear everybody's head off for no reason. I would read things into emails and texts that were not there. Even people talking to me, I'd be like, that guy's an asshole. And somebody, my friend, would be like, I don't send that reply just yet, Israel. That may not be what he meant. That may not be a good idea. And sure enough, doing the steps, first of all, doing the steps immediately, well, I immediately relieved some of my obsession to go drink. And it talks about that in the book. It says some people get 100% immediate, I don't even have a craving anymore. And some people, it's a little bit more of a slow burn. It was a little bit more of a slow burn for me. But I will tell you, it convinced me that there was a higher power because of this, what I'm about to tell you. Okay, people kept saying, you got to pray. And my dad was a preacher in this little 300-person town. And I had enough of God. I just focused on all of the bad things that can happen in organized religion. And that, to me, in my mind, was all there was. And so I didn't want to have anything to do with that. And so I was just going to try and skip over the God part and steps and hope for the best. My sponsor told me differently. And it's like, look, man. A lot of people come in here that don't believe in God. It's really not been a huge stumbling block. You just need to be willing. You need to make a start. And what do we say? Progress, not perfection. So my sponsor said, if you're just willing, you don't have to believe. Just be willing to try. That's enough to make a start. And it was enough to make a start for me. And out of spite, I prayed my first prayer in the program. I was probably sober a week. I wasn't sponsored yet, but I heard everybody talking about this prayer thing, and I was so pissed. I'm like, well, gosh dang it, I'm gonna pray, and it's not going to work. I'm going to show you. And at that point, I was craving alcohol Like, I would think about it, like, every minute. I timed it. And so I just said, fine. I got down on my knees in my living room. Nobody was in there. And I just reached out and said, God, can you relieve this craving? Can you help me out here? And wouldn't you know it, it worked. I got relief. It was immediate, and I was able to go, you know, 5 minutes maybe before I felt that intense craving again. It was enough. It was enough relief to make a believer out of me. And I even right now, I don't really know who's picking up the phone. I like that metaphor. You know, I'm picking up the phone, I'm sending stuff out there, and I don't know who it is, but the book talks about, you know, the spirit of the universe. Love that. You know, it feels kind of cosmic and bigger than me. And whoever it is absolutely picking up the phone and reaching down and working in my life. The crazy thing is, I wasn't even given anything back at the time. I was asking for help purely out of selfish reasons. And it still worked. So, you know, if you don't believe in God, that's all right. Keep coming back and make a start. Just be willing. So that's what it's like now in early sobriety. And I want to tell you a little bit about what it's like now in sobriety after being sober for 4 years. Man, I don't think about alcohol. Months will go by, you know. And it's just like, and it was like I woke up one day and was like, holy crap, I didn't think about drinking for a month, for 2 months, for 3 months. And that right there cemented, even more than the other miracles that I've seen in my life, that was gigantic. In addition to that, this people like to call it a God-shaped hole, and that really made me mad when I first got here. But that's what it was. The more that I grew my spiritual life through doing the steps and doing the prayer and giving it up to God, asking for relief, for being willing to be relieved from my character defects, that went away. You know, this hole in my heart that had been there my entire life. I mean, it's gone. I don't feel that now. It's amazing. You know, and I'll tell you, my best day in sobriety is, or my worst day in sobriety is better than my best day drinking. Absolutely. Absolutely has been. No matter what kind of challenges may happen in my sober life, I still can get relief from sitting down and do self-examination and say, like I did with that paper at the very beginning, what am I afraid of? What is this fear? Where is it coming from? Am I being selfish? Yeah, I am. So let's get out of that. Let's identify the character defect and let's be willing and pray to God to have it removed. And that stuff works, man. It works for me. So let me see here what else I got written down, because I'm so nervous. I wrote down a ton of notes just in case I ran out of stuff to say. I'm a little OCD like that. All right, so other things that what it's like now, okay? So before, I would have to force myself to be around people, even like my wife and my kids. You know, I would go out to dinner, and it would be a chore. And I knew in the back of my mind, I shouldn't be feeling this way. I should be wanting to go do this. So I need to act like I'm enjoying it. And it was hard to do. But now, in sobriety, I really want to go do all that stuff. I get a ton of enjoyment out of it. I can reconnect with my community, my family, all because I'm following this program. I mean, and it breaks it down super easy for me. I don't have to overthink anything. If I do, I screw it up. But that idea of being able to have real relationships again, bringing them to a level that I never even experienced before, was amazing. And my sponsor and I have talked about this. And, you know, we both kind of think that it's only because of the program and the things that we've learned here, the tools, that we've been able to really feel or really see what love is. You know, we kind of had distorted views of it before. You know, what can I get out of this interaction? not what can I give here. And now I find joy in that, the joy in giving things and doing things. And we talked about service. And this is kind of funny. I have complained before to my sponsor about people, doing things to me at work, really small things that I think are gigantic. And he'll turn to me and he'll say, "Have you done anything for anybody today? Take out the trash? Did you go get the mail? Did you hold the door open for anybody?" And more times than not, I'll have to say no. And then I'll have to make it a point to go do that. And so even the small things for me help. If I see, and I don't do it all the time, I'm not some perfect guy, but I do get like a feel good doing it. And it helps ease that crazy mind I got going on when I could be nice to people. Let them in traffic, instead of yelling out the window. That's actually a really good barometer for me, is how angry I get in traffic if I've been up in my prayer life. Because usually I'll go to the gym and I'll walk around the track and I'll pray and, I'll do some prayer time there. And if I don't do that, if I don't pray at night, maybe for a couple days go by, I start getting mad at everybody, especially traffic. So it's real. If I want to know what my spiritual condition is, I just got to get in the car and drive down Mooney. And, if I'm ready to kill somebody after a couple miles, it's like ding, 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 ding. Israel, you need to go pray more. You need to go pray more. It really does work. Sometimes we talk about chopping the wood and carrying the water of AA. I heard that from a cool speaker I listened to. And what that means for me is we got to be willing to do the small things. I've got to be willing to do the small things and show up. That to me is 12-step work. It's giving away what I got just by sitting in those chairs and being there. And I've experienced it from the other side too. Seeing old-timers in the room, guys with 30, 20, 30, 40 years with sobriety, and they're smiling and happy, and it's like, dang, just their presence in the room is proof to me that it works and that it's not BS. I did kind of think that when I first got here. But it's not. I can testify to that too. It's not BS. And so I would encourage everybody to get into service. It's helped me so much. Me and Bill and some other guys, we do this thing called H&I. It's called Hospitals and Institutions. And we go into the prisons. We go up to Corcoran right now. They just opened it back up since COVID has been evaporating. And man, that is the biggest charge I have ever had in sobriety. Going in there and talking to these guys. And at first it wasn't. At first I was a little bit, dang it, these guys aren't staying sober. They keep drinking and they come back the next week. And is this a waste of our time? And, my friends in AA tell me, dude, you got this all backwards. You are going there to help yourself. You're going there to give it away so you can stay sober. So it doesn't matter what they do. If they, you're just planting the seed, and be happy with that, and be happy in the knowledge that just planting that seed helps keep me sober. And that changed my whole outlook, and I started not caring. And let me tell you, even despite those frustrations of people not staying sober, and I'm getting over that. There are some amazing, amazing people in there that are sober. I've met folks in there with 20 and 30 years sober, lifers that are never getting out. And they got better attitudes than I do. And it just fires me up, man. So if you want to get fired up, get involved in H&I, man. It's cool. All right. Finally, let's see, mechanical process. My sponsor likes to talk about that. And I talk about my sponsor because he's got a lot more credibility than me. If I just say I thought about this, nobody would give me the time of day. So, but it is true. He does say this. He says that, and he references the literature that we have in AA, one day you'll be unwilling or unable to pray. And then what do? And he says, well, what you do is you do a mechanical process. You rely on your training. So it doesn't matter if you feel like it. It doesn't matter if you're not feeling connected to God at the time. Just do it anyway. Pray the prayers, say the words, read the prayers if you have to, and do the steps that we know. You know, I'm mad at that guy because he did that, and this is my part. All of those things that we learn to do by rote through the steps, if I do those mechanically, even when I'm having a rough time, even when I'm not feeling connected, it works. It comes back around. It always has come back around for me. Eventually, after a week or two, I start to feel that connection coming again, and it's awesome. You know, occasionally I'll feel that cosmic connection. Doesn't happen all the time, but sometimes sitting in front of a fire, you know, just kind of zoning out and meditating, man, it's just amazing. I feel at one with the universe. I know that sounds kind of corny and kind of silly, but it puts my life in perspective, and it makes me feel like I'm part of something bigger than myself. It's just like other people and my higher powers holding my hand, pulling me along, and it feels really good. So I'll leave you with this cool phrase. This is kind of like my cheat sheet for all the steps. I can categorize these steps, and I didn't come up with this. I stole this too, into three categories: trust God, clean house, and help others. And so if you ever are out there in your AA life and you can't remember all the steps exactly, they're categorized for me into that: trust God, clean house, and help others. And that's an awesome encapsulation for me of the whole program. And just want to encourage everybody, especially newcomers, man, keep coming back. It works. It worked for me. Stubborn, crazy, insane OCD guy. It can work for you too. Thanks, I'm Israel, and I am an alcoholic.